Hey everyone, welcome to the OFD Bookcast. I'm your host, Joshua Voles, site manager, emperor, supreme warlord, and defender of the faith over at onefootdown.com on the SB Nation Network. And that's right, folks, bringing the bookcast back into full effect after a couple of shaming comments from Jude Seymour, and then him starting the book club over this last week. It's time to, I gotta finish this. If you don't know, if you have any idea what I'm talking about, back the beginning of COVID, back in March, which is so long ago, but I started a, you know, let's do something. Let's do a little something more. And I thought, you know, doing a little podcast about some Notre Dame books would be great. I thought I'd get through like maybe like three books from then through, you know, through the summer up into the season. I did not get through one book. It's just, you know, scheduling and really just, you know, whatever, man. COVID really beat a lot of us down. So just didn't have much of an opportunity. And then, you know, once the season kicks in, and then it's all hands on deck for that. So let's get back to it. Let's finish it up. And who knows, maybe I'll be able to start another one, you know, so we can all have something to do in this off season. I think there's six episodes, of the bookcast, that are recorded. I think the last one was like in May. So yeah, it's been a few months. So if you don't know about this, if this is be the first time you've listened to the OFD bookcast episode, maybe go back and listen from the jump. Maybe add something I should have done so I can remember, you know, a little bit more of the format that I had chosen to go about all this. But that would just be more wasted time. So after a quick refresher, again, this is for the book Notre Dame's Greatest Coaches, written by Stephen Singular and Moose Krause, which is kind of a 33%, maybe more, maybe like a 40% biography of Moose Krause, and then 60% talking about Rockne, Leahy, Barsegian, and Holtz. And so, you know, I've read this book. I've said in the first one, I've read this book, I don't know how many times, countless times. I got it for Christmas on Christmas in 1993, when I was 15 years old in high school. I don't know how many, you know, I've read it countless times. So, you know, this is kind of a refresher, like rereading it. And it is funny, to go through this book with a, you know, to put together some bits, some tidbits to share with you. Whereas, you know, and I that would be with any book really. But you know, what information is interesting to you and what you retain and use and learn from, and then try to figure out if that's something that anybody else is interested in. I guess as a writer and as a website manager, maybe that should be second nature, but it never is an easy task, to figure out what you, the reader, listener, are interested in. So it's always a challenge. So, you know, I say that as a preamble to maybe this isn't your cup of tea. I hope that it is, because I think there's some kind of fun, interesting stuff in here. But you know, if it's not, hey, there's still the regular OFD podcast, which, by the way, is a reason why that that the bookcast is happening again right now. Again, we're away from our two episode a week schedule from the season, and this week, I guess normally we would do our OFD podcast. We record it Sunday night. We're going to record that Wednesday night instead this week. So that kind of gave me a little bit of an opening to kind of kick myself in the ass a little bit and to do this again. So hopefully this will get some more normality out of the podcast schedules. And I'm not talking about like OFD podcast, you know, Sunday and Monday nights kind of alternating. It's kind of how we do things mostly. Everyone, you know, we'll kick it to a Wednesday or whatnot, you know, just kind of how things work for us. But getting a second something up, whether that be a bookcast or an off the rails, or maybe just a random interview, you know, with somebody, you know, I have some other ideas in mind. So it all falls under the scope of the OFD podcast. Hopefully we get enough stuff out there for you guys. You know, so you have something to, you can listen to my raspy ass voice, on your way to work or whatnot. And just a reminder too, please get over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating, leave us a review. 5-star ratings are just like absolutely gold for us. That helps us, when people are out looking for Notre Dame podcasts, that puts us up there with everybody else. And again, the OFD podcast is a little bit different. Hey, fuck it. It's a lot different than what everybody else got on. We can say that. Other Notre Dame podcasts may try to sell a little bit of their difference. And they're really the same as a lot of other ones. This one is a lot different. As far as I know, we listen to a lot of them, and that isn't a knock on anyone else. It really isn't. I just think that we look at things and do things a little way differently than everybody else. So it's fun, but leave us that rating review, and whatever review that you leave on Apple Podcasts, I will read on the next OFD podcast. It's a promise to you, to have your voice heard, not only by us, but by all our listeners. You let us know what you love, what you like, or what you hate, what pizza, I mean, just whatever, beer, cocktails, whatever you put on there, I'm going to read. And we've had some unfortunate incidents where I've had to slander good names of wonderful things. It's all in good fun. All right. As I feel my mouth already getting dry, and sitting down to record this and one of those non-pause things that I can't just get up and get something to drink. So let's get this thing. I'm absolutely dry over here. So let's get this thing rolling. We are through 14 chapters of this book. And so we get to the 15th chapter, and where we last were at, Notre Dame had just had a brutal loss to Stanford in the 1992 season. And the 1992 season is kind of one of those lost years where there was just so much incredible talent on that team. It's hard to imagine that they didn't win a national championship. I mean, that you could say that a lot from 89 to, you know, to 92. Again, at OFD, we count 1993 as a national championship. But that time between 89 and 92 is like, oh my God, you know, there's like, how is there not one more, two more, you know, attached to the whole thing. So, things are a little dicey, and you know, this is old school kind of life, you know, football coaches and how they deal with losses. And so the chapter begins with Moose showing up to practice. He's kind of giddy about this. So, you know, he was kind of hoping for Lou Holtz to be in what you could say a mood, kind of, you know, basically pissed off tyrant, is what Moose was looking for. And he kind of felt like, you know, he's yearning for that. Like he was, you know, needing to hear that kind of passion and that kind of, fervor that you would get from a head coach like Lou Holtz after a loss. And, you know, to some degree, you know, that's how it is for many, many coaches. But I just thought it was interesting that, you know, Moose, it seemed like in this chapter, like he was excited to get to practice. He wanted, you know, unlike some of the players probably who were dreading going in there, to have to deal with the loss and the week ahead. I think they were getting ready for Pitt that week. Moose was pumped. He was ready to go. So, you know, it talks about him, you know, walking by Rick Meyer going on in and to the Loftus, which by the way, back then the Loftus was the new thing on campus. It was the new thing. So this was a, you know, like, oh my God, Holtz is taking him indoors to the artificial turf. It's kind of funny how long ago this really was. You walk by Rick Meyer and as he's smoking a cigar going into the Loftus, telling him, hey, you'll get him. So when we talk about the brutal nature of football, when you talk about, like, when you get real visceral, when you talk about football being a violent, archaic, barbaric kind of sport, a lot of that's from what goes on in the trenches, offensive line, defensive line action. And for many Notre Dame fans, that really puts you into what is arguably one of the greatest offensive line coaches of all time, and that's Joe Moore. Like, look, the best offensive line award in college football is called the Joe Moore Award. And for Notre Dame, Joe Moore was there's a greatness thing attached to it, and then there's kind of like an embarrassment thing attached to it. You know, the greatness of the times with Holtz, and then with Davey when there was the lawsuits because Joe Moore had sued Notre Dame and Bob Davey for letting him go, basically because saying he was too old. There's a lot of Joe Moore stories out there, and this is not going to be the podcast where we get into it. Maybe that deserves an episode all on its own one day. But that's not what today's going to be about. But if you can imagine all the stories you've heard about Joe Moore and the brutal nature of what he does, what he was doing as an offensive line coach in Notre Dame, imagine going in after a loss. Imagine going in after a loss to this man, to this no bullshit, to this no nonsense, to this small man, but large, like just this great thing. Like Joe Moore, like Harry Hiestand is talked about in this manner with his players. And I would say Joe Moore is probably like times five when it comes to the toughness factor. So this was lining up to be, just a brutal time for the offensive line this week of practice after the Stanford loss, getting ready for Pitt. So where did he, let's say, here. The players at the end of the field were engaged in blocking drills. A number of them stood off to the side, helmets in hand, sweating and heaving from the workout. They watched as two huge linemen faced each other in a crouch, shoulder to shoulder and nose to nose, waiting to collide. "Go!" Joe Moore shouted, and the linemen went at one another with a ferocity that could be heard and felt 30 yards away. In 1988, when Holtz was looking for a new offensive line coach, he talked to a number of people about the best man to hire. Jackie Sherrill, who coached at Pittsburgh, Texas A&M, and Mississippi State, said without hesitation, "Get Joe Moore." Moore had been one of Sherrill's assistants at Pitt. Others told Holtz similar things. He took the recommendations and offered the job to Moore. The 60-year-old has a gruff voice, a weathered face, and sad eyes with bags under them. When he yells, he sounds twice as big as he is and half as old. Everything about him conjures up the Marines. Over the past half decade with the Irish, he's consistently produced one of the best offensive lines in the nation. Let's see here. Okay. Moore had once been a running back at the University of Tennessee, but later decided, he spent 17 years as a high school coach before moving on to college, that the offensive line is one of the few areas where you can make a player better. He has only one inviolable rule with his linemen. Don't ever ask me how well you've played or try to influence my opinion of your performance. You have no say in that. I'm the one who makes the judgment. And he doesn't care for the questions from the players during practice sessions. Questions are for team meetings. At practices, he likes action. "Go!" Moore shouted, And the same two young men went at it harder than before. And so it's kind of a quick look at Joe Moore in this time. And more than that, this chapter shows a warrior in Moose Krause, the old warrior in Moose Krause, watching Joe Moore develop New Age warriors as Moose is an old man. Look, I've said, I think Steven Singular is not, I don't think he's a very good writer. The book is a hard read at times, the way he hops around, and he gets these moments of really, and we're going to get into that, of kind of flowery language. And he gets into, he tries to tap into the poetic side of football. And I get the sense, that Steven Singular wasn't much of a football guy. Honestly, cause the way he describes a lot of these things, kind of seems like, yeah, no shit, or a little over the top. It really is an interesting look. It shows the way Moose, or he talks about the way Moose reacts to the blocking that he's watching in practice, about the bleacher shaking from him laughing and, you know, choking down that cigar. It really is something. I mean, he really gets into it. Sorry about the pause here. It's just me. All right. He says, you know, this looks like the old days. These kids need a good kick in the butt. I told you Lou might be a little upset today. I mean, this is what he wanted. This was Moose's fix. And you get the sense too that, you know, losses, Notre Dame football losses affect fans in lots of different ways. I mean, some fans take this shit like extremely personal, and their whole week is fucking ruined. Now, you know, and coaches do that as well in a sense. But I mean, think of it from, it's a hard perspective to really wrap your head around. With Moose Krause, you know, this is a retired athletic director who was once an All-American lineman, All-American basketball player, assistant under Rockne, under Leahy. This guy, again, Mr. Notre Dame, this is Notre Dame. And so watching the way he takes losses or, you know, reading about how he took these losses is interesting because, you know, if you're taking it harder than Moose Krause, maybe you're taking things too seriously. You know what I mean? Like if Moose Krause is just, if he's able to move on, still be a little pissed, you know, he's looking for some revenge, but he's moving on. I think you should move on with what you're doing. Moose Krause, allowing all these different coaches that he's been around in his life, you know, allowing the coach to be the coach and to say, you know, that they, to basically say, you know, they know better, than he does about what they want for their team. You know, that, speaking to everybody out there, myself included, you know, if Moose Krause says that, thinks that, maybe we should, you know, reexamine a little bit in the way and how we look at this. Not to be like to just fall in line with everything, but to be like stupidly overly critical about things. It's kind of insane when you think about, you know, that you're working in a, you know, in a title office, trying to be an offensive coordinator. You know what I'm saying? it is kind of one of those, you know, that armchair quarterback kind of things. So I always find that fascinating, and I find Moose fascinating in that sense, and just how much he really, or how he reacts to these games. The book talks about, you know, kind of like the strain that game in particular, but all these seasons have had on, on Holtz and on Notre Dame coaches in general. But it talks about how Holtz, you know, was different as far as, you know, his media persona and, you know, his locker room persona, you know, and how those didn't really, entwine. But, you know, it does talk about, you know, the expressions that Holtz would make across the field to, you know, opponents, like basically like he's ready to go out and kill somebody. It says, you know, you need a little rabid dog in you with all these top coaches. And you did get that with Holtz when he was out in the field. So let's see. Here's another passage I wanted to read. This was a whole session of just of Moose getting his good feels on by watching Joe Moore coach offensive linemen to kill each other. This kind of blocking is what I used to teach. Mooch was saying, for years and years. Back then, the players weren't trying to block each other, but me. We just beat the hell out of one another all day. I blocked 10, 12 guys at practice. I never lifted weights, but I was pretty strong. In those days, we didn't have a weight room. Another pair of young men were lined up next to Moore. He walked around behind one of them, and as he yelled, go! He placed his shoe in the huge fellow's posterior and gave it a mighty shove. The blocker rushed headlong into the opponent, who was just as big as he was, and was determined and under just as much scrutiny. They smashed together and dug in, the grunting and the impact reverberating up from the field to where Moose was watching, reaching him and stirring something within the old man. He smiled and shook his head and tapped his cigar ashes near his shoe. Oh, boy, he said. Aren't you happy to be here and see this? This is just like when Leahy was coach. So I'm saying, it's a yearning for that battle, for that brutality on the field. Again, Moose was giddy to get to this post-loss practice. It was, it really was quite something. This is where, and maybe I will just read it. This is where Singular tries to get very deep and poetic about football. And it's not that he's wrong. It's just that I don't think that he's right. 100% right. Because I don't think that the person that he's kind of quoting here is accurate either for the modern era. Let me read it and we'll get into just a little bit. Okay. For a moment or two, there was a sensation in the air that you were not watching a football practice in 1992, but something else entirely. An ancient male ritual unfolding before you, the sort of thing that we often think of as having taken place in more primitive times. The elders of this particular tribe down on the field were instructing those who were on the threshold of adulthood, and the older men had been given the complete authority to do so. They could say whatever they wanted and do whatever they felt was appropriate with their charges, because it was understood that all of them were involved in something larger than their own individual lives. The younger ones weren't simply learning how to become members of their own group. They were being initiated into the duties and responsibilities of manhood. An implicit level of trust between the young and the old made all this possible. The sensation passed, but some part of it lingered, and with it became a peculiar glow of satisfaction, very unexpected and hard to account for at first. You had the feeling that what was taking place at practice was not only connected to its own revered tradition, Notre Dame football, but to something much deeper and richer than that, something that went back further than anyone could possibly remember. In The Power of Myth, a show that ran on public television and was later published as a book, Joseph Campbell had said that what was missing from contemporary life and what had become the underlying source of many of our troubles was that modern society had lost its ability to turn boys into men through meaningful rituals. Long ago, he said, tribal elders had done this by putting their youths through intense physical hardships or by humiliating them in a group setting or even by cutting them and leaving a scar. Young men were given the chance to show their strength and courage to prove they had qualities to be adult males in the tribe. Some were weeded out. The purpose of the rituals was not to harm anyone, but to let the youths know they were no longer children. They were members of a social order and had the obligation to exercise self-control toward themselves and others. Without these things, Campbell had said, young men can easily become lost in their impulses. Holy shit, what was that? young men can be... damn it, man. This is not a good podcast. Without these things, Campbell had said, young men can easily become lost in their impulses towards sexual chaos or violence. The rituals help form the basis for what is perhaps the oldest known form of male bonding. In our time, the term has become cliche, at times a joke, but it was important in certain ancient cultures, and there is still much evidence that we've evolved a great distance away from what we once were. Civilization, it has been said, is the thin veneer over what made us what we are. Now, I understand that this is how a lot of people feel. I think it's like mostly horseshit. I'm consider myself a pretty tough guy, I guess. Fuck, I don't know. But it really does borderline on the kind of like the toxic masculinity effect of what's going on in this age today. I think there are certainly as a father of two boys, something I struggle with, is how to make them men. But I think, what makes men men, I think is different. It has changed over the years. This isn't, I don't care what they say. This isn't fucking ancient Greece. I don't need my sons to be able to go out and kill a couple of wolves and before the age of 13 and make it back home in the middle of winter. So you cannot apply the same type of philosophy, like wholly, to 2021 and beyond. I mean, you just can't. It's not the same. It's different. But there are characteristics of men being men, I suppose, that should be there. And that's about decency. It's about hard work. It's about honesty. It's about, the fortitude, the will to keep moving. Those types of things, but that doesn't have to be in football. That doesn't have to be wrapped up in some type of ritual. Again, Steven Singler, he really digs deep for, I don't know if he was trying to go for some kind of prize in this book, which, come on, man. But he does go on these tangents throughout this book. So bringing up Joseph Campbell, who I actually enjoy quite a bit, talking about the heroes and the power of myth. There is actually some good stuff in there, but just that part alone is a little over the top, man. It just really is. But again, it does. He's doing it to help describe Moose and this overall male figure that Moose was. We're talking about, the hardest of hard asses, but in a sense of, but a respectable one, a man who, who cared for his family, a man who, was just a pure brute, on the field. A man that had to develop himself into a civilized person from the streets of Chicago, you know, up through South Bend, you know, going, the man's been through a lot, but he really is the duality of his nature is something else. And I think that more or less, I think that's what he's trying to get at is the overall person that Moose is. And he goes on to talk about, you know, how he's, you know, not a saint. And there are some things that, you know, about Moose that, you know, by today's standards, you know, wouldn't cut, which I mean, I guess most white men from the 20s and 30s coming in, you know, today's standards of 2020, 2021. Yeah. It's not going to be your grandpa was not perfect. All right. Most of your grandfathers out there had said some shit or done some shit. And I'm not apologizing for any of them out there. I'm not saying any of it was right. But to think that some of these figures from our past didn't have flaws, like these great heroes of our past, as if they didn't have flaws, is completely wrong. And Moose Krause, who's one of my bigger heroes, you know, not just with Notre Dame, but just, you know, as you're growing up, when I mean, I was 15 reading this book about Moose Krause, I'm like, oh my God, this man is amazing. You know, and I've looked at him as one of those people, you know, one of those people that have, you know, affected you as far as, you know, what was their life like, you know, so anyways, but that's what this chapter was basically trying to get across was getting across that, you know, Moose was a very complicated figure. But you know, easy to understand, I guess. I don't know. Maybe that makes it more complicated in itself. Maybe I'm just talking completely out of my ass, which is entirely possible, and that's fine. But so I found the chapter here. Let me read this. It says, part of the aura that moved around Moose was just that. You sensed that he'd managed to balance these forces within himself, the sweetness and the darkness alike. He still enjoyed doing good and unexpected things for other people, even for strangers, and he still enjoyed watching a certain kinds of violence. But this came about in appropriate ways at football games. He found his own balance and contentment. So, you know, leave it at that. I thought it was an interesting chapter. Again, I just think it's funny that how giddy he was to show up to a Joe Moore, to a Notre Dame practice. And he talked about, you know, because of Holtz, but he's sitting there in front of Joe Moore because that's the one that's going to, you know, lash out the most, I suppose. So he got his kicks in that way. So I thought that was fun. So then moving on to the next chapter, and we're doing chapters 15 and 16. So, and this one's, it's kind of a strange title, I guess, in my mind. It's the end of era. And it really doesn't talk a lot about the end of era. It starts to, and, you know, talking about, you know, his 11th season, you know, 1974, following the 74 season, which was his 11th at Notre Dame, you know, it kind of goes into, you know, talks about, you know, it was like being on a treadmill, his blood pressure was high, taking medication, he was exhausted, you know, all these things. And, you know, and he told his wife he was done and he needed a break, and he didn't want to be on TV. He needed that 1 year break in between whatever it was. And we all know, you know, Era didn't coach again. I think it's interesting because it's like, if you're not going into the NFL, if you're not going to coach in the NFL, how do you coach after Notre Dame as a head coach? And what's interesting is that, I mean, up until just, you know, we're a lot longer than that. But I mean, Willingham was the first one. It was the first one I kind of thought of. Holtz obviously went on at South Carolina. I think it was I can't remember how many years break that was. But you just don't think about it. You think of kind of like Notre Dame being the last stop for these coaches. And then, you know, you kind of had these string here of, you know, of Willingham and then even Weiss, you know, at Kansas. Bob Davey, you know, stayed out of the game for so long. finally, servicing in New Mexico, and the man couldn't even make it to South Bend for when they played us. But again, there was this exhaustion with Era more than anything else, and exhaustion can lead to all sorts of problems just medically. There was this exhaustion with him that just took him down. I mean, took him down and like ended his career. And the same thing can be said about Frank Leahy. The exact same thing can be said about Frank Leahy, and Frank maybe even more so. And we'll talk a little bit more about Frank in this chapter, because it is a good comparison. Holtz was different. Holtz managed his emotions a lot better than both Era and Frank. Frank didn't manage his emotions worth a shit, period, at all. And, you know, it was brutal. The brutality of your own self, expectations is what hits on him. And that's what it was for Frank and for Era. The book says here, as with Rockne and Leahy, when people talk about Persijan now, they recall more than anything else in his intangible qualities, his fervor and passion, his single-mindedness and intense focus and will, all things that swirl around a person and can be felt but not directly seen. When the man himself is no longer present and all the games are over and his coaches and players have scattered across the nation, what lingers is the spirit he brought to the job. Which is true, but it's even greater than that. I mean, it's just that passage kind of spoke to it as like kind of like how you're remembered in a way, but it's also like that's how it takes you out. It's how it takes you down. And we'll never know with Rockne because of the plane crash, how that was going to go. Rockne seemed more, I don't know. I'm not an expert on Rockne at all, but he just seemed more in tune with his emotions with the game. And I guess, when you're winning at an 881 clip, those losses aren't, you're not getting those losses as much. But the losses are brutal. But anyways, so this whole chapter, the end of Era, but it really just like brings it back to his time at Notre Dame and just how passionate he was, how kind of crazy he was in a way. I mean, there's some messed up things he does here. He's intense in everything, is I guess what you could say. Let's see here. It says, the pressure Era felt at Notre Dame was largely self-imposed. He never got it from Moose Krause or the administration. He beat himself up when they lost and took it very personally. He felt that the product on the field was an extension of himself. Lou Holtz is the same way. Every Saturday afternoon in the fall is a final exam, and you're responsible for 120 young men who play football for you. And those kids are 18, 19, 20 years old, and they're expected, under the national microscope, to be nothing less than excellent. That's the standard here. People don't come to Notre Dame to kill time. I love that line. People don't come to Notre Dame to kill time. You're absolutely right. And as someone who did not attend Notre Dame, I talked to enough alums. It's just different, man. It's just different. I love that phrase. They don't come to Notre Dame to kill time. The whole thing about, graduating in 4 years, here is your plan. That shit is took seriously at Notre Dame. Not just with the athletic people that don't talk, but just coming in there you're not going in there to be milling around with your majors, and people do it. I mean, you're going to change your life direction because shit, for anyone at 17, 18 years old everyone to have it figured out about what they want to do with their life is a joke. And it's actually a sick joke that we play on human beings. But, the kids at Notre Dame, they're self-driven. Or legacies whose parents are telling them what to do. But to get it done. And so that kind of all makes sense there. That's why when you talk about like locker room fits and cultural fits in Notre Dame, some of these players that come in there, yeah, they needed football to get into Notre Dame for sure. But that same type of drive, that same type of will to succeed in life, is very much the same with them as it is with, you know, Joe McSorley, you know, engineering major. That's why that whole cultural fit and all that, that makes sense. You know, when you're recruiting guys, it just does. So it kind of goes on through some of these stories about what Era does. I tried to pick out a few that I thought were kind of funny, or just, you know, interesting in itself. It says, "What I remember most about Era was his intensity during practices and games. You try to stay as far away from him as you could. We lost 4 games in the 3 years I was at Notre Dame." And this is Bob Gladeau. Says, "We ate our meals in a dining hall, and after a loss, Era would sit there near the door and not touch his food. He would stare at every player in the eye as you came in to eat, those big, dark Armenian eyes coming right at you. We'd watch him and whisper, 'He still hasn't eaten. He's waiting for the next player to come in.' As you were sitting there trying to eat, he would come up to you and talk about the game we just lost. He'd talk about the stupid mistakes and the penalties. Some people take things harder than others." And that was Era. He took it harder than others. A loss was took harder. That toll, and that's why it's mentioned in this chapter about the end of Era. That toll that you build up over 11 seasons at a place like Notre Dame just was constant. And it just beats you down. Beats you down to the fucking ground. And it really is amazing that Brian Kelly has been at Notre Dame this long. It really is amazing that, especially in this era. I mean, Persegian did not have to deal with the internet. He didn't have to deal with a whole lot of uncooperative beats. The Notre Dame beat and the press itself, and just America's outlook at Notre Dame was a lot different than it is now. And I think Brian Kelly has to deal with 3 times, 4 times more shit than Era ever did, regardless of the wins and losses. I mean, it's just a harder job. I think it takes a bigger toll on you. There's so much more demands on Kelly. And so Kelly's time, you look at this and the greatness of Era and that time at Notre Dame, you know, beat him down. And then look at Kelly now. And we're talking, you know, that contract extension through 2024. You know, we've talked about, like, he may not leave. I mean, he may get yet another extension. I don't know, but I mean, it just kind of feels like, you know, that he could, he found a way at Notre Dame to keep moving. So anyways, I thought this was pretty funny. When Era came to Notre Dame, he hired a defensive coordinator, Johnny Ray. And the way he hired him is just, I just can't imagine this happening in college football nowadays, especially for these big teams. So what happened was the National Convention of Football Coaches, which is a big kind of like hiring kind of a thing. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on at these conventions about, you know, coaches and, you know, looking to, you know, to move spots or move up in the world and all the stuff, blah, 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 blah. Well, in June of 63, Era was getting, before he got to Notre Dame, Era was getting an award for what he was doing at Northwestern. And Ray was getting one for, I think he said John, yeah, he was at John Carroll. He was getting one for the same award for a smaller school. And there was this weird kind of thing where about Ray giving a speech there. And Era just like kept calling him. about how, what kind of speech he's going to give. And you know, according to this book and a few other things, Johnny Ray, number one, his mouth was running most of the time. And he was like one of the few guys like that would talk back at all to Era. So he's kind of pissed because Era's been up his ass about this, you know, the speech at this convention in June. And he kept calling about this and all that. So, you know, finally, you know, the time comes and it's in December. And Ray gets this message to meet with Era in his hotel room, like at 8 o'clock sharp, like be there. So Ray's going in thinking this is about this fucking speech, which is just pissing him the hell off. So it says, at 8 o'clock, I walk into his hotel room and he's sitting on his bed with his shoes off. I sit down and say, don't worry, my speech is ready and it's good. He says, that's not it. I want you to work with me at Notre Dame. He says, and Ray says, I can't. I just got a job at Wake Forest. He gets up and starts shaking his head, talking about Era. Oh, no, 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 he says. That won't work. You going to Wake Forest as a Catholic is worse than me going to Notre Dame as a Presbyterian. I tell him that I don't know if I can be an assistant coach anymore after being a head coach. Well, Era was a salesman. He tells me that if I go to Wake Forest down in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, my career will be buried. He goes to the phone and calls the coach who had just been fired from Wake Forest, Jerry Hildebrandt. You know, Jerry isn't going to say anything good about the place now. Era gives me the receiver, and Jerry tells me, there aren't any players down here, and being Catholic in this place isn't easy. Era hangs up the phone and looks at me. What'd I tell you? He says. You hate it down there. Then he makes me call my wife and tell her we're moving to South Bend. She was really surprised. Then I had to go make my speech. That's the way Era did everything right now. Ray became the Irish defensive coordinator and assistant head coach. Think about that for a minute. This man had a job as a head coach at a Power Five school, basically. I mean, even then, Wake Forest has never been good, but it's Wake Forest. And Era just basically told him, no, tell your wife and you're coming to work for me. It's kind of just amazing. That doesn't happen at like Michigan State, even if Era's there. I mean, the Notre Dame poll has something to do with it, but it's just insane. I mean, think about how we hire. It's just like, think about what we just went through getting Marcus Freeman to Notre Dame. That's just, are you going to get Marcus Freeman to, you know, turn down the head coaching job at Wake Forest to be the defensive coordinator at Notre Dame? No, that's what he's there. He's going to Notre Dame to get that Wake Forest job. So it's a different world. It's a different way of doing things. And just the way that the balls Era had here. I mean, just the pure set of balls on him to talk a guy out of doing that is pretty intense. So I know in other episodes we talked about the how much the Meeker penalty against Southern Cal, the one that cost Notre Dame undefeated season national championship, how much that affected Era and Moose. And the Colonel, for that matter. It does say something in here about Johnny Ray talking about the lousy holding penalty on Meeker. I mean, that was a – you want to talk about penalties. And this is recording after watching the Green Bay Packers kind of get hosed by the refs because they had some love affair with Tom Brady. But it's just funny. I mean, it's sad and it sucks, but it's kind of funny, like how much this shit like gnaws on people. So, I mean, I don't know. I would love to hear, to hear the guys from that area, like ask them about that penalty. And you'd probably get like a 45 minute soliloquy about it all, which is just funny as hell. So it does kind of, so then it goes on to talk some more about, you know, just the era. I mean, again, like how much this, you know, all affected him, how, you know, how he dealt with it as a person. Let's see here. It says, his pep talks were prepared very carefully. He'd write it all down and study it. But when it came out, it sounded spontaneous. I was at Notre Dame briefly under Leahy, and I coached against other men, including Bear Bryant. I can't remember who's talking here. Oh, it must be Wally Moore. But Era could adjust to things during games better than anyone I ever saw. He would talk to the players and ask them questions and learn what they were doing out on the field and make the adjustments right then. Leahy would get so worked up at the games he couldn't do that, which, like I tell you, maybe that's why Frank's my favorite, because I feel Frank, like just being so like insanely like into the your emotions just take you over so much that it misfires your brain. I can feel that. I can feel that. So it says, when I think back to Frank Leahy, I laugh. He had two things he always said to you when he saw you, no matter what. How's your weight, lad? How's your family? That was it. My answer to the first one was 185 pounds, and the second one, fine. One day, Leahy sees Johnny Lujack on campus and says, how's your weight, lad? Lujack says, 284 pounds, coach. Frank says, and how's your mother? She's dying, Johnny says. Frank nodded and just kept walking. He was thinking about football and didn't hear a thing. He was the most concentrated man I ever saw. I mean, for Lujack to like just say that in itself, like you knew that he wasn't paying attention. So that's why you say what you said, because you knew that. I mean, he's not gonna say anything. So yeah, 285 pounds. Mom's dying. Okay, laddie. And you know, again, this different eras for these coaches, different kind of ways that you know that they do it, how it goes about. How players react to it all. And, you know, so when Notre Dame traveled to other games, he said, I stayed in the suite with Era. The other coaches got to go out the night before the game, but I was stuck with him. We'd sit in the room and he'd say, are we ready? Yeah, I'd tell him, we're ready. He'd ask me that 20 times. He left nothing to chance, drove me crazy. He'd sit there and think up the most bizarre circumstances. If our three quarterbacks got hurt, for example, what would we do? He'd always have to have a disaster quarterback around who can hand off the ball. And then we'd have to have a backup for him. He's the most thorough man I ever saw. And so, I mean, I think nowadays some of that seems more natural. Like, I think fans think that way. And, you know, and so like getting down to your fourth string quarterback is... I think that's more of a common thing nowadays than it was back then. I mean, you probably have a third string quarterback there anyways. So you get through those three, it's your walk-on. The next one's a walk-on who's took snaps, who's handed off the ball. I mean, so kind of like, oh, that's all built in. But it really kind of wasn't the way it was then. But, you know, and that's what these huge-ass rosters. So, I don't know. But it's just another detail, just another thing about Era. Just beating it home about what he's all about. there's a story too here about just kind of like kind of how Era was just kind of a dick sometimes, and not like a dick like not a dick like a jerk, but just kind of like fucking with guys. Let's see. Says, Era's a strict Martinet, he says. I love the guy, but whenever he lost a game, oh boy, you had to walk on eggs in his office for a week. He didn't say a word. He had a sense of humor, but he could be a SOB when he had to. And this is from Moose. Says Moose, when Digger Phelps came to Notre Dame to coach the basketball team, Era hid his office furniture in one of the bathrooms. Digger couldn't find it for a week. I love it. I fucking love it. I don't expect that from someone like Era. I wouldn't. And I found that bit of info pretty cool. I thought it was pretty cool. Like, so, oh, you're the new basketball coach coming to Notre Dame? Yeah, good luck finding your fucking office. And the fact that back then, I think if you couldn't find your office furniture, someone would get you office furniture like that next day. The fact that it was gone for a week is also, you know, kind of, you know, pretty funny. Guys, is there anything more out of here that we really need to talk about? I don't know. All right, so I'll read this passage as kind of like an ending here. And this is from Dave Casper, All-American tight end for Notre Dame. Everyone knows who he is. It just talks about like, okay, so I'll read it and it'll make sense. I never wanted to talk to the head coach. My whole career in high school and college and in the pros, I tried to avoid that. At Notre Dame, I showed up every day my last 3 years with my head shaved. Era said I couldn't wear my hair long. I wanted to cut it once a year, so I decided to cut it all off. Era understood his purpose. Fans want to be entertained, but players want to be coached. We thought he was impersonal, but he was really just very organized and kept things simplified. I played for John Madden and Bud Grant and Tom Flores in the pros, but Era was the most organized I was ever around. He didn't try to get in your head and talk to you very much. I really like that. How far can you get into the head of an 18-year-old? He didn't beat you up, and he didn't overpractice you. His workouts were humanistic. He was the first person to understand that you don't need to get in better shape for the football season by hitting people in the spring practice. You just get injured. So he brought in dummies and let us hit them. My senior year, I was elected captain of the team. Harris said no long hair and no facial hair. I went into him and said we wanted to stay in touch with the student body and what they were involved in. He listened to me. He let us go out and socialize more and let us grow mustaches. He understood that the most important question was whether you played hard on Saturday and played with discipline. Over time, he relaxed a little. And when something wasn't working, he would change his mind. He let me be me. I just wanted someone to tell me what to do and then leave me alone. He did that. I made only one mistake my senior year when I jumped offside in the Sugar Bowl. When I came back to South Bend after the game, I went into the athletic department and saw him in there watching films of the games. His first words to me were, "Why the hell were you offsides?" I just learned to stay away from him, and that was okay with Era. He only made 4 or 5 comments to me the whole time I was at Notre Dame. He didn't mess with my mind. He knew what you went through as a football player. I've seen Era in recent years, and I've always sent him a Christmas card when we're together. He's still the coach, and I'm still the player. And so I'm just leaving you with that. So, again, the whole point of the chapter was to beat down, was to show, like, this mental exhaustion of Era. And it really didn't end with that. I mean, it didn't show all of that. It just showed that his obsessive nature with being the coach at Notre Dame. And that's just, you know, I guess that just kind of comes along with the territory. So that's that. So thanks for hanging out with me here for this bookcast. We'll get back into it. Jude shamed me into getting back and finishing this book up. Since, like I said, we didn't finish it. So we'll get to chapter 17, I think 17 and 18 next time around, sometime next week. So let me know. Let me know what you guys like, don't like about this. Again, go to the Apple Podcasts and leave a rating review for the OFT Podcast. And you can talk about this particular show in there, too, if you like. And that's it. So I'm going to wrap this up and get the hell out of here. And until next time, go Irish.